From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we take a step back and look at an important experiment that's been taking place in Philadelphia, led by our regular political commentator, Professor Tony Montero. It's called the Saturday Free School, and this past weekend, they marked the fifth anniversary of its founding with a symposium held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where they examined questions like this.
From our standpoint, that is from the standpoint of the Saturday Free School, and this is not just my opinion, the failure of what is considered the left, you know, and a good number, especially of the young people who are part of the Saturday Free School, have come from some of these small left organizations. And they've come to the Saturday Free School, which is more than a school. If you read our mission statement, we consider ourselves an instrument of the people. They come to the Saturday Free School because of the stagnation in ideas and in tactics, strategies, and imagination of these small left groups. And of course, now with the collapse of the protest, which, you know, kicked off right after the election of 2016, now that they're not happening anymore, now that the liberals and the neoliberals have found peace with Donald Trump since he's bombing Syria and is prepared to go to war with North Korea, the small left, the radical left, and the broad left are left without a mass base, and they don't know where to go, they don't know what to think, because their strategy was based upon the fact that there would be this ongoing conflict between the liberals and Trump, and the liberals would keep masses of people in the street, and they would join it in order to get in front of it, that is the left. So that having collapsed, the question of where do we go from here, or what is to be done, or how do we think about the world is front and center. And so many young people have joined us. That doesn't mean that in joining us, they abandon activism. It means they join us, and their activism, I think, becomes far more effective. We could talk about some of the activism of the Saturday Free School.
Well, you know, the part I want to get to first, to sort of contextualize that, is the acknowledgement or even the, you know, placing at the center of it, the class character of the educational process itself. You know, we've discussed before, and you've brought to my attention on a couple of occasions that, you know, we have to remember that in academia, the class membership of the participants, even if they were born into the working class, is a petty bourgeoisie. And that informs the educational process, you know, absent some really strong countervailing movement, very strongly. So you have people that are attempting to provide an ideological framework for the working class that come from outside the working class. And here you're talking about having the working class, members of the working class, come in with what they know and discuss it from that perspective, and then attempt to, you know, use some sort of a framework for understanding it more deeply and using it.
Well, you know, just on this thing of these universities, if you haven't been in a university in, let's say, 15 or 20 years, and you came into one today, it would be something very, very different than what you had seen previously. Or if you had gone to the university and you graduated 30 years ago or more, these are not the same institutions. These are profit-making institutions that in themselves contain intense class divisions and intense class conflicts. For example, two-thirds or more of the teaching faculty in universities are without tenure, without health care, without security, and are more or less exploited by a hierarchy that includes the administration, but also includes a good part of the senior or tenured professors. And this situation creates a lot of class antagonism, so much so that graduate students are organizing unions, adjunct and non-tenured professors are organizing unions, students are protesting over debt and a less than adequate education where they teach, you know, pop culture and that type of thing, and they never hear about, for example, W.E.B. Du Bois or James Baldwin or any significant ideas. A small percentage of the students perhaps do. But the broad mass, you know, universities brand and sell and market themselves as places where you can come and have fun and have an urban experience, in the case of Temple University and Penn, and be credentialed, and you won't be challenged if, you know, most of these are white kids from suburbs and rural areas, and you won't have to put up with radical ideas like anti-racism or anti-homophobia or gender equality. You won't have to, you know, be, you know, and you can just go through and get a degree, and the idea is that once you graduate, you get a good job. Well, a lot of that is collapsing on the basis of this class conflict within these universities. So, you know, that class division has shaped the form of knowledge, not just the form of what is taught, but how knowledge is produced. Because, and what we've discovered, that most of your tenured professors are separated, not only from the working class, but from the world itself. And so they come up with all of this phony language that has to do with identity politics and difference and everything but issues that confront the masses of working people. And so one of the, you know, as you mentioned, one of the panels was on that very topic and how, in fact, a part of the struggle for ideological clarity and to advance the cause of the people is to take on these universities and to kind of like pull the veil off of them, to strip them naked, to expose them to the people, their gentrification, their super exploitation of their employees, how these are elite institutions that are usually more like hedge funds and real estate speculators than institutions of debate and learning and knowledge creation. Yes, so that's part of what we do.
And it's interesting that you mentioned it, particularly the gentrification aspect.
Yeah.
That is something that you have some deep knowledge and understanding yes. of from confronting Temple itself on the streets of Philadelphia, basically, as it attempted to continue a path of gentrification, consuming black working class communities in Philadelphia, like Nellie Bailey with Columbia in New York City, and I'm certain people all over the country running into the same phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And you know, I experienced the other part of this, too, being fired because I hold radical views. I mean, it was no secret that once we confronted the administration and the head of the Department of African American Studies, it came out and they said it, that I was nothing but a communist apparatchik, purveying a low-level purveyor. Now, I'm quoting them. Of Marxist ideas and other anti-African ideas, you know? So this intimidation, now, you know, the difference, I guess, between myself and most people that suffer that fate is that they go quietly into the night. But I'm from North Philadelphia, and of course, you know, a fight was on. And, it, you know, it's interesting, Don, that fight continues.
Well, you got nowhere to go. That you are home, so you can't leave.
Yeah, right. Literally, you're in my house.
That's right.
And you're going to try to put me out of my house.
No.
I don't think so. And, you know, it's so interesting And a lot of people who are not familiar with the student movement or young people or only know it through news media accounts, even social media accounts, you know, are not aware of what's going on. First of all, I'll tell you this. It is more difficult for students to organize now than it's ever been, I think. Even if you went back to the McCarthy period and so on. The first thing is that students have to work so much as well as study. So they're exhausted all of the time. The other thing is, and this is perceptible, they have very, very little, if any, support from the faculty. Students will hold, you know, just wonderful events, and there are no faculty that show up. There are no faculty that say to their students, you should attend this. In fact, faculty tend to discourage student activism. Of course, the atmosphere created by the administration is one that of partying, of non-engagement, of fear of the poor and black residents that surround these universities, of a conflictual attitude towards black folk and poor folk. And so students organizing with advanced ideas find it very difficult, but they do it. And I'll tell you, Don, my observation is that they're doing it better than I ever remember it being done. There's a coalition of about 12 student organizations at Temple University called the Black Brown Coalition. But it's not just black and brown. It's Asian. It's South American. You know, it's a collage of different races and ethnicities and nationalities. But they had an event on Mumia Abdul-Jamal, which for Temple University in the heart of Philadelphia is profoundly transgressive given the power of the Fraternal Order of Police and other reactionaries in the city.
Right.
And they have this event. And you know what they called it? Mumia Abdul-Jamal, a revolutionary love supreme. Mm. And as the program began, or as we were gathering, they were playing that album by John Coltrane called A Love Supreme. And the thing is, you know, John Coltrane, when he and his mother moved from North Carolina to Philadelphia, they lived in North Philadelphia, only a few blocks from where the Temple campus is. So, I mean, these students are on another level, intellectually and ideologically. They understand things that, for example, the student anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s didn't understand. They understand the imperative of class and of unity of the students with the workers on the campus, with the poor and working classes that surround these campuses. And they understand the connection between student debt and anti-gentrification. So it's a new day. We just have to continue to fight to consolidate, ideologically consolidate the student movement, to make sure that they understand that movements go through periods of ups and downs, that everything that calls itself the left is not the left, that everything that appears to be, and I put quotes, revolutionary, are not that, and how they have to have critical minds and so on. So it's an interesting thing.
So I really want to kind of parse this particular aspect of the ideological, which is that the portrayal of, I'm going to assume, of the work that you're doing now in the same manner that they did the work you were doing as they were exiting you from Temple, being anti-black, studying Du Bois, mm-hmm. Malcolm, Mao Zedong, Huey Newton, Amilcar Cabral, Kwame Nkrumah, Ho Chi Minh, you know, how exactly, you know, how anti-black is it to study Assata Shakur?
Right, right. Well, and you know, so interesting, all of the names that you mentioned were referenced and discussed at the Celebration Conference this weekend.
Okay.
All of them, including poems by Assata Shakur and Amiri Baraka. And I think we had poems by Ho Chi Minh even read. So, you know, what they're defining, or what some in the academy define as black, is really anti-black. It is, especially at Temple in the African American Studies department, which is not even a department anymore, what goes for, or what is defined as blackness, is some sort of narrow cultural mythology about what Africa was and what Africa is and what is African and who is African, and all kinds of crazy sociobiological theories like melanated people versus non-melanated people. And
it's a reflection of white supremacy's own, it's like caricatures of white supremacy's own imagery.
Well, and the fact that this stuff can get a hearing and be institutionalized as African American studies at Temple University reflects the growing decadence and irrelevancy of a good part of academic knowledge, and that these universities and their professors have become separated, deeply separated from the people of the United States, and in many ways become the enemies of the people. That's what we're looking at. And you're paid a lot of money, and you're given secure positions to promote ideas which are anti-black working class, anti-black poor. And the idea is to educate and socialize a new generation of young black people who will become the next generation of black misleaders, and will take, you know, all of the forms of, quote, black cultural identity, but in substance will have worldviews that are anti-African-American and anti the masses of Africans on the continent of Africa.
You mentioned the intensification of the process and the actualization in a deep way of the process of the corporatization of academia in the United States in particular. And, you know, you certainly see that in, you know, large institutions like Temple, Columbia, you know, et cetera.
University of Pennsylvania, yeah. Harvard, Yale,
right. Yeah. All
Berkeley.
Over,
yep.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at things like African studies, you know, American history, you know, whatever, things that deal outside of the strictly technological. If you think in terms of logos like McDonald's or, you know, Burger King or something, then the particular philosophical school in each of these areas, or the contextualizing school in each of these areas, might as well have one of those logos attached to it.
Absolutely.
And then it helps you understand exactly what you're really looking at.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the role of sports and in particular, to give a brand, to give a name, you know, and you know, Temple has had a really poor football program for decades. It's no big thing. I mean, you know, what is football?
Football.
I mean, that's nothing. But they had a winning season a couple seasons ago. And suddenly, they see themselves as becoming a football power. And therefore, they have a need to build a football stadium right in the middle of the black community and the poor community in North Philadelphia, I mean, which we've been protesting mightily. It's a branding. And of course, the big places, the prestigious places like the Harvards and the Yales and the Ivy Leagues and the Berkeleys and the University of Chicago, well, they already have been branded over multiple decades, and they're seen as prestigious because they are centers of learning, but others have to do it in other ways, through advertising and sports and, you know, selling themselves primarily, in the case of Temple, to the white middle class, who see Temple as both affordable and a place where, you know, your kid could go and have a good time. Yeah, that's part of it. So, you know, in this mix, especially of Temple, which is wider now than it has been in decades, Temple had, as a city school, as an urban school, at one point had close to 30% of its student body being African-American, and the vast majority of them being from Philadelphia high schools. Now, if you come to Temple, it is whiter now than it's ever been. So they cannot afford to have an African-American studies program that engages in critical thinking. For example, at Temple, you can take African-American studies, but never seriously consider the works of Du Bois or Baldwin or Angela Davis or Assata Shakur or Zora Neale Hurston or anything that has to do with the civil rights movement. But they have at least five or six courses on various aspects of hip hop culture. For example, you can take a course in Tupac Shakur, but there is no course W.E.B. Du Bois and the Color Line. There is no course on James Baldwin and whatever you want to title it. Nothing. So you can get out of Temple and not have read Du Bois, Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright in any serious way.
Wow. You had to read those in Austin High School.
Yes, yes. In fact, at the conference, a brilliant presentation was given by an undergraduate student from Temple. And she said precisely that. She said she went to a kind of a magnet high school in Baltimore where they read Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. And she expected, coming to Temple, that, you know, she could further pursue questions in that novel and others in the Black literary canon. And she said she deeply disappointed. No Ralph Ellison in African American studies. But yet all of this talk about quote unquote Africology. In fact, they have renamed the Department of Africology.
What?
Now, what the hell is that?
Whoa.
You know? So it is as much as I dislike what the people in the Department of African American Studies are doing to the students and to the Black radical and intellectual traditions, you have to put the final blame at the Board of Trustees and at the administration, who are very, very pleased with this type of watered down, almost comical Black Studies program.
And finally, going forward, what happens at, well, first of all, very quickly, just tell us what a typical Saturday is like at the Saturday Free School. And what do you got planned like coming up?
On a typical Saturday, you have anywhere from 30 to 50 people. By the way, we started at Temple University. I started it in 2012 as a way to join the students at Temple, particularly those in African American studies, in dialogue with people from the surrounding community as a kind of beginning of service learning. And we started at 9 o'clock. Then the only difference is we have a different location. We're at the historic Church of the Advocate, which is in North Philadelphia, a beautiful, unbelievable place of art and culture. And we could go on and history. The only difference between the change in location is that rather than start at 9 o'clock, now we start at 9:30. Start out, you know, you know, chatting and drinking coffee and eating some small snacks and so on. And then we begin, our reading could start, and we, you know, we're text-based as well as experience-based. So we were doing Das Kapital. We didn't do the whole work. We just did the first chapter on the commodity and applied it to an understanding of the current crisis of neoliberalism. And that forced us to go to Lenin's imperialism as we look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership and neoliberal globalization. But then, you know, we did Huey Newton's memoir, Revolutionary Suicide, and one of our members is the former field secretary of the Illinois branch of the Black Panther Party. And she knew Fred and was, you know, there when he was assassinated, that is Fred Hampton, and so on. And now, you know, well, we did Du Bois' Black Reconstruction. We literally did the whole thing. And that was major. But now we're on Baldwin and his essays. And we're doing The Fire Next Time, in particular, the essay Down at the Cross that is subtitled A Letter from a Region of My Mind. So we begin there. And here you have this community of learners and thinkers and activists that range everywhere from shipyard workers and longshoremen to retired workers to young people who, a couple of them, are PhD candidates in theoretical physics, from the University of Pennsylvania and Cornell University. We have a person that comes all the way from Cornell University to the Saturday Free School. Wow. And undergraduate students from Temple University and Drexel University and the University of Pennsylvania. And, you know, the thing that is so deep is the mix of nationalities and civilizations. For example, Vietnamese, Indian, Pakistani, Japanese, and of course, you know, the majority are African Americans. The other thing is the organizations that people and movements that people have come from as well as are currently involved in. Everything from the Black Panther Party to the All African People's Revolutionary Party, the Nation of Islam, the Communist Party, from the various unions to the current student movements, to the activists who are involved in trying to build a peace movement among students and in the community, to those who come out of the movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal and other political prisoners. Pam Africa, who is very well known, is a regular member of the Saturday Free School. In fact, at the conference, not only was Pam there and spoke, but also Mumia's older brother, Keith Cook, attended and spoke. So it's that type of mix. And we have, you know, we've come to what I consider to be a common worldview, a common understanding of the current crisis, and a common approach to what is to be done. And what we believe is key is the ideological and political education of the masses, the promotion of the idea of the organic or community-based intellectual. We give as much value to the autodidact and the self-taught person who, based on their experience, has engaged ideas at the highest level to those who are university trained. So that's what you would see on a normal Saturday at the Church of the Advocate. And by the way, members of the church attend, including the pastor of the church herself, Pastor Renee McKenzie.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.